By the way, everybody, I think I've been enlisted to do a little extra duty toward the end of the year. George is going to have a much-earned vacation toward the end of the year. You know, Christmas to New Year, that sort of area. And, of course, Ghost to Ghost AM, the traditional, and then the predictions for the new year, all that sort of thing. And, by the way, I'm going to have the network collect those predictions because I'm afraid they remain locked in the Bell family vault. So, are you listening, network? I'm going to need a list of last year's predictions. I'm sure you have that on record. Sorry to put somebody through going through all that, but it's just one of those things got left out as I headed for the other side of the world. John Mankins is here. He's got 25 years collectively with NASA and JPL, and it's not very frequently. It's not very frequent that you ever get an opportunity to ask somebody of this caliber a question. So that comes next. This is Coast to Coast AM. John, I certainly cannot guarantee what awaits you, but I can tell you that every single line is blinking, so a lot of people want to talk to you, that's for sure. If you're ready.
Okay.
Okay, here it comes. Wildcard line, you're on the air with John Mankins. Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, hey, how you doing? My name is Jim. I'm calling from New York. And I just wanted to talk about solar fusion. I wonder if you guys are familiar with that. If I could resource an article from Inc. magazine, July of 05. The gentleman's name is David Slauson. And to sum it all up, he more or less said that if you canvas 1% of the world's deserts, you could supply 100% of the world's needs. And in order to displace the usage of the fossil fuels in the U.S., mm-hmm. you need a solar fusion farm of 100 miles by 100 miles.
Right. So I'm familiar with the concept. It's basically a very large solar, either photovoltaic or solar dynamic farm where you have a very large number of solar arrays deployed someplace where the sun shines a great deal, either in, for example, in Arizona for North America, and then you ship the power around wherever you need it.
Correct.
Yeah, the central challenge, there are a couple of central challenges with that particular architecture. One, obviously it's going to work when the sun is shining, but you do have challenges with regard to when the sun is not shining. Namely, you need a considerable amount of energy storage. The other challenge is that it won't necessarily work for all locations in the world, and there are some technical risks with regard to taking large amounts of power, gigawatts, hundreds of gigawatts of power across some international boundaries, some geopolitical issues. So the fundamental trade, there's always going to be an increasing demand, I mean, I think for the rest of the century, for more and more solar power on the ground. The more fundamental competition is between the energy storage systems that you need for ground solar power and other competing technologies, whether it's, you know, carbon sequestration or solar power satellites.
Mm-hmm. And you think solar powered satellites will, for example, John, in Nevada, where I'm from, or in Arizona, as you point out, or that part of the country, generally, you have in excess of 300 days of sunshine, usually. And when you don't have sun, you usually have wind. You also have a great deal, about 90% in the case of Nevada, of government land. That's an awful lot of area where you could put an awful lot of solar and wind power.
Yeah. No.
I mean, how does that add up compared to doing it from space?
The challenge, the best recent study was actually done by the European Space Agency. They looked at a very similar scenario where they would, and they didn't take into account any kind of geopolitical issues. They looked at the engineering of putting a very, very large solar array in North Africa, large enough, 100 gigawatts, so that it would provide a substantial fraction of the energy for Europe, and then bringing that energy around, say, through the Middle East or up through Spain, through large cables, power cables, high-voltage cables, compared that to the space solar power case. And they ended up with about a wash, i.e. the cost of the two approaches if you included the energy storage, because it's such a stupendous amount of power that you've got to store, that it turned out the costs were about equal.
Okay. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with John Mankins. Hi.
Yes, sir.
Proceed.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
This is Bob in Mansfield, Ohio.
Yes, Bob.
I was wondering if we could convert the liquid storage tanks on the shuttle-type mechanisms to Dewar flasks so we could reduce the foam problem and then take them up into space for your hotels or to continue to increase the size of the space platform and eventually use that for ablation and thermal shielding. And when you want to go to Mars or the like, you just tow this thing that you keep raising to a higher and higher altitude as you use the garbage as your shielding.
All right. What about that, John? I've heard that proposal made by many.
Yeah, and there's a very nice website which has been up for a long time. It's the Space Island Group.
That's right.
Has been looking at the potential use of the space shuttle's external tank for other purposes in space for a number of years. And I guess the difficulty, of course, for the shuttle is that the rest of that infrastructure is already coming up on 30 years old and is at the end of its useful engineering life. And so replacing a particular element like the external tank when there's only 3-4 years left in the overall system is problematic. It doesn't.
That would have been a viable idea, though, years ago.
If it had been designed in, if you go back to the decisions that were made during the Nixon administration, in the face of strong budget cuts from the White House at that time, if you could go back then and somehow get a little extra money, another $1 billion, and design that in, then you could have done it. But putting it in after the fact is just very, very hard.
Got it. Okay. First-time caller line, your turn with John Mankins. Hi. Hello?
Hello?
First-time caller line, yes?
Yes, hi. I was listening about that design where the tube in the space and everything using electromagnetics, one based on the Earth and the other one based in space. I wanted to know, basically, lines of flux that propagate don't propagate straight. They're more of a clover leaf when they come off, going from north to south or from south to north, whichever. So how would you solve the problem of that tube wanting to roll off to the edges? If you hold two magnets together, they hold together fine as long as you got a hold of them, but the second you let go, they move off to one side or the other. So how mm-hmm. would you solve a problem like that? I was wondering.
Yeah, it's a the guy in question here, his name is Jim Powell, and I would actually, for details, I would refer you to his patent, because he does have a patent on the StarTram. But the simple answer is the electromagnetic system is actively controlled. So, you're absolutely right. If you take two permanent magnets that are not in some way controlled and you try to get them to sort of float on top of each other, it won't work. It's like an egg standing on the pointing end. It wants to slip off one way or the other.
That's right.
But if you dynamically control the fields as it tries to slip, you can adjust it so that it'll stay floating. That's sort of the basis of how these the maglev trains that Jim Powell and Gordon Danby originally invented in the 60s works. And it's been tested very successfully in Japan, for example. So it definitely works.
It sure does. Wildcard line, you're on the air with John Mankins. Hi.
Wildcard?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Art. This is Steve in Los Angeles. How you doing?
Fine, Steve.
Great. Listen, I've got a question for John Mankins. It starts at the top of the hour, the thing you asked him about the UFOs. John?
Okay.
Yes.
What is your question?
John. Hi there.
Okay. John, hi. Are you aware that NASA produced a TV show, and in that show they showed and told that every flight to and from the moon was accompanied by a physical or nebulous object, and they showed all the pictures?
What program was that? I'm curious.
That's Los Angeles TV show in the late 70s. It might have been on Channel 11. They showed everyone. I'd just like to point out real quickly one that really caught my attention because I saw James McDivitt on a TV interview previous to this show in which he said he took a picture of a cylindrical object with an appendage coming out the side, like a Coke can with a straw coming out the side. And when he got back to Houston, they said, no, we don't have anything like that. And then NASA's show, you know, produced, and at the top of the show, they had a disclaimer that said, you know, this may alarm some people. And they went one by one through all the flights, and they said, and here's James McDivitt. And boy, I said, oh, boy. And there it was, just like he said, a cylindrical object with an appendage. And every flight to and from the moon, they showed all the objects. So where has that information gone? I can't be the only one that saw the show. I mean, that information needs to be brought back
sir,
to the public.
Yes. Are you sure that was a NASA production?
NASA.
Actually?
Absolutely NASA-produced show.
Okay.
Absolutely.
John, are you at all familiar with that?
No. I've never heard of such a thing. But I have to say, I wasn't with NASA in the late 60s. I was still in college. Or late 70s, I was still in college. But I have to say, it doesn't sound like NASA media policy.
No.
NASA wouldn't ordinarily do a program like that. It's just, it's not like NASA.
NASA would
support other media activities, but...
I would have to agree with you. It doesn't sound like it would be NASA. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with John Mankins. Hello.
Hello, my name is Abraham. I've just got this really weird question. I was watching something on the Discovery Channel a few days ago, and it was about a laser-propelled craft, basically, that they're working on, and they actually showed this thing, and it was operable. But I only caught a few minutes of it. I was wondering if Mr. John there happened to know anything more about it.
Yeah, I think most likely what you saw was a thing called the light craft. And one of the strong champions for this concept is a gentleman by the name of Lake Mirabeau, Myrabow, as I recall. His first name is Lake. I think it's Leik. He was for many years a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic. I don't know where he is now. And his work on the light craft, I actually sponsored. I funded that when I was back in the mid-90s when I was in charge of advanced concept studies. The idea is a very interesting one where you power, basically keep your power generation on the ground and you beam power to a vehicle as it's going up. There are a couple of dilemmas with the concept that you might want to look at. Probably the biggest one is that it's hard for it to carry any payload. You can get enough power to it without breaking down the air. It's a question of energy density. You can get enough power to it without breaking down the air for the vehicle to sort of stay aloft, but it's hard for it to carry any payload. So it's hard to see how it becomes an economically cheap way to get things to orbit. But you might Google it, light craft and Lake Mirabeau.
That is fascinating, though.
And
conceivably, you could take smaller objects, John, with that technology and get them to orbit?
Absolutely. And it looked interesting enough for us to invest in it at the time.
Well, the reason I asked that is you were talking earlier about smaller objects with the intelligence of an insect being able to, once they were up there, essentially assemble themselves into something. And if this was a way to get smaller objects into orbit, and you mated those two, wouldn't you have something?
It would depend on whether or not you could get enough power to get a meaningful payload up there. It's a challenge. It's a challenge.
Okay.
These modular robots that we were talking about earlier, they tend to sort of be really successful if it's sort of human size and larger. So like 100 kilograms, 100 pounds to 1,000 pounds. The kinds of light craft that Lake was looking at are much, much smaller.
Okay.
Mylar balloons. They're a little bit like Mylar balloons that are pushed or accelerated by a beam of light, a laser beam.
Got it. Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Yes, this is Donald from Kingston, Tennessee. I wanted to ask Mr. Mankins how he felt about the astronauts and the dropping the bolts in the spacewalks.
And I think they dropped one bolt. Isn't that so, John?
I think when it was at the end of the week, I think they'd lost a couple of bolts.
A couple of bolts. Okay.
If I only followed it in the media, but that was my understanding. It is just so hard for the astronauts to maintain their dexterity over a very long extravehicular activity, an EVA.
Yes.
Because their suit is under pressure, and and the outside is a vacuum, and so they're constantly fighting with their hand strength. Astronauts have really strong hands, but they're just constantly fighting it. And I can just easily see where by, late in the EVA, it's just going to be hard to hold on to a small object like that.
Sure. Now, I guess the danger of a loose bolt is that even though it simply harmlessly floated away from the space station, it's still going at, 18,000 miles an hour?
That's no danger to the station because they're moving in the same orbit.
Right.
And in due course, the bolt will slowly decelerate and move away from the station and re-enter the atmosphere, become a little meteorite. The challenge is when you've got an old object that size and it's coming at you in a different orbit.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there are a number of other low-Earth orbiting satellites, are there not?
Not that many. There are a few, but... A decade ago, there was lots of plans for large constellations of low Earth orbit satellites, but the way things turned out, there aren't all that many in the same kind of orbit as the station.
All right, East of the Rockies, you're on the air with John Mankins. Hello.
Hi, Vinny from Avon Lake. You pretty much answered my launching laser question, so I have an alternative question. A caller called in, I don't know, a couple years ago about raising a small satellite up with a balloon it floated to the top of the atmosphere, he claimed, and then he kicked it out with a small explosive. I was wondering if anything to do with a balloon would be feasible.
Actually, it's a very good question. If you could get out of the majority of the atmosphere, I imagine you've got quite a boost. It's kind of what you've been talking about, right, John?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a whole family of concepts that we described in our studies in the 90s as launch assist, things that help you get started in your launch. And launching from underside the wing of an aircraft like the Pegasus launcher does from Orbital Sciences, that's a company that makes it, that's one approach. Going up on a balloon and launching, that's another approach. Going from a catapult, but one that's on the ground, a mag lifter, that's another approach. All of them have some advantages. The balloon one has actually been looked at in the past, and it does give you some advantages because of the altitude. It doesn't give you as much as, say, the sea launch concept, where you take the rocket and you take it on a seagoing platform down closer to the equator, where you get some of the advantage of the Earth's spin on its axis. But the balloon launch is a perfectly viable strategy.
How much advantage do you have by launching closer to the equator, as a matter of interest?
If you're right on the equator, the spinning of the Earth, and you launch in the direction of the spin, the spin of the Earth gives you an advantage of about 1,000 feet a second. I think it's 1,000 feet a second.
That's amazing.
Yeah, as compared to, say, the poles. That's one of the reasons why the same rocket delivers so much less payload if it's going into a polar orbit against the spin of the Earth or independent of the spin of the Earth versus launching due east. That's why all the launches that go up into as much as they can, you want to go due east. The European Space Agency built their launch facility at Kourou, in South America, to be very near to the equator.
Uh-huh. Actually, I'm fairly close to the equator right now, so I'm spinning a little faster.
Yes.
Hadn't thought about it. All right, John, thank you very much. Hold tight. We've got one more segment to go. John Mankins is my guest from Manila, the Philippines. I'm Art Bell. Good morning, or whatever it is where you are. John Mankins, with 25 years at NASA and JPL, is my guest. Not too frequently do we get an opportunity to ask somebody of this caliber questions. This indeed is your opportunity. More of it in a moment. It doesn't necessarily directly relate, but I love this fast blast from Gary in Long Island, New York. He says, hey, Art, any new exploratory projects on the horizon soon from NASA? Well, that relates, I guess. He says, Gary, down the street from Brookhaven Labs, no black holes yet, house still here. John, anything on the horizon exciting?
In terms of sort of exploratory R&D, a good place to look is to check out the website for the NASA Institute of Advanced Concepts.
Mm-hmm.
The NIAC, a gentleman named Robert Casanova, is the director of that that center, and they do a lot of innovative work. Seems to me they just recently selected a bunch of new projects that may be going forward.
Gotcha. All right, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with John Mankins. Hi.
West of the Rockies, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Art. Hi, John.
Hi.
I had a question. It's a little on the smaller scale about solar energy and like about how much it would take to run like your shop tools, like a water water feature in your yard.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's try and answer that, and then I don't know, even expand it to a home, for example. I could actually answer that. I can't. I don't know what it takes today, John.
Well, nominally, if you want to run your home, you need something like, depending on the size of the home, something from like 3 to 5 kilowatts. Depending on what you do at night, for the there's a great many websites these days that offer insight or information into what you can do with home solar photovoltaic systems. The production is so high and the market has just grown so much in the last 5-10 years. In general, the efficiencies are going to be something like 10 to 20%, which means something like 10 to 20% of the sunlight which falls on that part of your roof is going to be turned into voltage.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's the middle of the day, so it's not in the afternoon, if it's the middle of the day, you might get 100 or 200 watts per square yard of solar array. And so it would depend on how much power that you want to have come from solar versus from the grid.
And for her question, there are all kinds of spiffy new products on the market today that run, for example, small fountains and lights that will stay on all night and that sort of thing. There are all kinds of things like that out there right now. But when you're talking about powering a whole house, it takes actually a lot more than people imagine. You use more power than you imagine.
Yeah.
That way. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with John Mankins. Hi.
Hi, Art. John, it's a pleasure. Been listening to you since the early 90s.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, calling from the Gulf Coast here. I was just going to ask the Honorable John, what about gravitationally assisted spaceflight along magnetic lines or grids that exist in the universe, but not just shooting yourself around the moon or something, but maybe 100 years from now, maybe propel yourself from one star to the next, creating more and more velocity in your spacecraft, possibly even reaching a percentage of the speed of light by actually tuning into the frequency of 1,000 points of light at one time and propelling yourself across these magnetic lines or grids in the universe using gravitationally assisted flight.
Gravity assist per se is a technique that was invented back, I think, in the 60s. The way gravity assist is used is typically for a spacecraft to come in and sort of slingshot off of a larger, more massive object like a planet and pick up energy from the planet that it goes swinging by. There's another approach for using sort of the complex gravitational fields in our solar system, which is called the gravitational superhighway or terms to that effect. The gentleman that you might look for on the internet, his papers, his name, as I recall, was Martin Lowe. Another lady was a university professor, as I recall, her name was Kathleen Howe. It was basically using the complicated gravitational fields of the sun and the moon and other planets to follow very low energy paths through space. You can go from point A to point B without using a lot of rocket fuel. The dilemma with those, which is really cool, and they're very efficient. The dilemma with those is that they tend to be very slow. You sort mm-hmm. of follow the path of least resistance, and you slowly glide from point to point.
You do gain acceleration, but very slowly, right?
Exactly. And so you don't get anywhere very quickly, but you get places very, very efficiently. There one other comment with regard to interstellar flight. There actually was a concept that was looked at. It came up with some years ago by Freeman Dyson, a truly brilliant man, to use a very supermassive object like a neutron star to get up to relativistic speeds. The big dilemma, of course, is that there aren't any of those in our immediate neighborhood, which is a good thing, actually. And so they're not very useful in trying to get to star flight anytime soon.
Okay. East of the Rockies, your turn with John Mankins. Hi. Hello.
Hello. Hi. This is Christina.
There you are.
Ronfels, Texas.
Yes.
I wanted to inquire about Bill Nelson, who was with NASA probably about 20 years ago. And he came up with a machine for alternative healing, and it was used for when astronauts had headaches or had physical problems.
All right. Are you familiar with that, John?
I'm sorry. I don't know the gentleman. So I can't comment on it. I'll look it up, but I don't know him.
The machine has now been updated, and it's called the SCIO, S-C-I-O.
Okay.
Well, I guess we don't know, but we'll certainly look into it.
I hope so. Thank you.
Okay. You're very welcome. Take care. Let's go here. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, John. This is Jeff calling from North Carolina. My question to you is actually a couple of questions. One, what do you think will be the best use of the International Space Station? My guess would be like protein crystal growth. And my second question related to that is, there's some concern about taking research funds and utilization funds from the ISS to pay for the next space vehicle. And don't you think that sets a bad precedent by taking away utilization and research funds? So what do you think the best product is, and what do you think about taking away research funds for the ISS?
Yeah, clearly, if just going to the latter one, since the U.S. has invested tens of billions of dollars in this orbiting research laboratory, it seems somewhat penny-wise and pound-foolish not to make the modest additional investments that are needed to use the space station to do the kind of research that it's capable of doing. So obviously, I think that there needs to be an adequate investment in space station-based research. In terms of which kind that I think is going to be most profitable, I think I have to admit that I'm biased. As I said, I'm a physicist. My background is largely in the engineering sciences, not in in biomedical sciences. So my own tendency is to look for the biggest value to come from the use of the space station as an engineering test facility, as a place where we can go and try out really exciting new technologies with the opportunity to tinker with them and with a relatively low marginal cost, and to do so very quickly and to do it in space. The biomedical research, I think, is going to be good. It's going to be useful and interesting. I don't know whether or not protein crystal growth per se will be that profound.
Let me ask you a very loaded question, John.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume that we did not have the International Space Station where it is now, that there was nothing there, and that you, for example, were going in front of a congressional committee, and you were asked to provide good, solid reasoning why we should begin to build the space station at perhaps $100 billion or more cost. Could you justify it? Would you justify it? Or would you argue against it?
If you were starting from scratch, I would argue for a space station. But I personally would probably argue for a space station along more modular lines. So you'd, mm-hmm. one in which you would build multiple copies of similar modules rather than the current architecture from the early 80s. So I would make the argument for a space station. I don't think the cost would need to be as high as it in fact has turned out to be. The line of arguments I would probably make would involve all of the new technologies that I need to demonstrate and to do so cost effectively, things like electric propulsion and advanced robotics and in-space power systems, and the fact that I can use the space station as an engineering research laboratory and as a testbed for all of these individual experiments. And when I put them all together, the net cost, the total cost of the collection of experiments is going to be much, much cheaper than if I had to fly each one individually.
Okay. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with John Mankins. Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. This is an incredibly sensational show. My name is David. I'm a past guest and the author of a book titled Sunstroke.
Oh, hey, buddy.
Hey, Mr. Bell, my gosh. Congratulations on your phenomenal achievement in broadcasting directly around the world from your Manila,
amazing.
Philippines, tropical paradise. My gosh, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Oh, my gosh, you're doing such a tremendous service for us all. And I especially want to thank you, of course, for mentioning my book tonight.
You bet.
Oh, gosh, this is an incredible accomplishment, sir, which you have achieved at the Philippines. And I do have a question for your very distinguished guest, John Mankins.
Far away.
John, this is a genuine privilege to speak with you. And I would like to ask you, sir, if you have read the U.S. Office of Technology's assessments, evaluation of solar power satellites. This was published in the early 80s by the U.S. Congress. Have you read that document, sir?
You bet. The OTA report, 1980 or 81. I have a copy.
Right. Okay. Do you remember that on page 180, that it clearly states that ionospheric heating could disrupt telecommunications, including AM radio broadcasts. Do you remember?
God.
I don't remember each page. I'm sorry.
Of course you would. I'm just
okay. Let's just take it. Let's talk about ionospheric heating, John. How much ionospheric heating concerns would there be with something like that?
Yeah, it was a legitimate concern at the time. There has been some excellent work that was done by the Japanese. This gentleman I mentioned early in the show, Professor Kaya, who was one of the co-inventors of this the retrodirective phased array, he did a sounding rocket experiment in which he took a small spacecraft.
It was called the Mimix Project.
The Mimix experiment, and he ran tests. Beaming power through the upper atmosphere to look for those effects.
Right. He succeeded in generating 300 watts of power very briefly, just for a few minutes, on a ground-based receiving station. Really sensational test of the system. Now, John, to your knowledge, has the U.S. ever duplicated that particular type of project, a very small scale?
We talked about it in the program back a few years ago.
Right.
The only tests that were done on the U.S. side that I'm familiar with were done at much lower altitudes. Like, for example, the very high power test that was done out at Goldstone.
Exactly. Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Yep.
And, John, I do have another question, if I may, Mr. Bell, ask this other question. Are you familiar at all with also the OTA's assessment of tropospheric heating? Now, they do state in the same page, 180 of that document, that tropospheric heating could result in weather modification. Have you conducted any other further research into the possibility that a solar power satellite employing microwaves could possibly modify the Earth's environment?
Mm-hmm. Reasonable question, I think.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with any specific report by OTA on that subject. I am familiar with the general theme, though, and there have been some published papers, I believe, at the International Astronautical Congress on this recently. The general line is that you have to choose the frequency at which you would do the power beaming specifically to modify the weather. Otherwise, if you go with a normal kind of frequency, the kind that you would use in a solar power satellite, you get very, very poor coupling with the troposphere, and you don't get good coupling to the climate, to storms or weather or that kind of thing. And if you wanted to affect them, this is the basis of these papers, then you'd have to choose a frequency that would be absorbed deliberately in things like weather patterns in order to get those effects, in order to modify the weather. But you couldn't do it with a normal solar power satellite. You'd have to build a system specifically for that purpose.
Well, both of those are intriguing. International Line, you're on the air with John Mankins. Hi.
Hi, George. Hi, Don.
Hi.
I have a point to make. It's kind of a question and a comment. I guess it comes down to, I guess, effectively being able to do some of the research or, you know, put funds into not so much the institutional level or government level, but even, you know, sort of free enterprise inventors or, you know, guys out of the shops that have these sort of good ideas. Has NASA ever looked at using a approach that similar to what the Defense Department does for, you know, autonomous vehicles and such? Have you ever thought about putting money into, say, you know, competition-based, you know, public input?
Kind of like a, I think he means kind of like a DARPA thing.
No, I understood. I have to say, you know, it's not the right personal pronoun since I'm no longer with NASA. But there is a thing called the Centennial Challenges, which is a current program out of NASA headquarters. And they have what are really relatively minor prizes being offered for in a variety of different areas, like a half a dozen different areas. One of them does involve power beaming, and it's related to the idea of space elevators, where you would beam power. The competition is to beam power to a machine that would ascend a cable, like a space elevator going up the strands of the Buckminster Fullerene tube. So there is a small competition in that area at this time. I don't know of any others, though, that are related to space solar power.
Okay. You have a website, right?
I do.
And what is on that website?
And in fact, I had an update to the one that's listed on your, the question, what the hell did I do?
Our website?
The one that you had listed on your website, is a link actually to my consulting site.
Ah.
Which is a different one. If you go to another website, which is the, www.spacepowerassociation.org. That's a new website that we're building for the SunSat Energy Council and provides information on the space solar power and on the council. And there's the old website, which is also still current, which is, I think it's sunsatenergycouncil.org or sunsat.org.
All right. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure having you here, John. We will do it again for sure. So thank you for staying up late, and thank you for informing us, my friend.
It's my pleasure.
Take care. That's John Mankins, 25 years with NASA and JPL. It has been a wonderful night, and I will look forward to seeing all of you tomorrow night. Same time, same station is the way I think the expression goes. So even from the other side of the world, that's the way it works. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Night all.